The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
The week started off with the very first Americans receiving Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine. And just yesterday, a second vaccine, this one from Moderna, cleared a key hurdle in its path toward FDA emergency authorization. But this week will also be remembered as the one when America started to come to terms with the breadth and depth of what some experts are calling one of the biggest cyber attacks of all time.
Overnight, the most powerful snowstorm in years slammed into the Northeast. Tens of thousands of people lost power in Virginia. New Jersey is under a state of emergency. Hundreds of flights canceled, rail service limited. The winter wallop coming as UPS and FedEx rush to deliver coronavirus vaccine shipments.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
This week, let's summarize and talk about the few key events that influenced stock prices. The first of which was news that Mayor de Blasio of New York City was warning of a full shutdown of the city, coupled with other reports that several European countries were taking similar measures, took the wind out of the sails of a rally that started that day on Monday due to news of the first vaccine administration. The next item that had a rebounding effect on the stock market Tuesday was a Nikkei report that Apple's production rate was expected to be up 30% year over year for the first half of 2021 for its high-priced phones. The news launched the S&P 500 heavy hitter Apple up 5% on the day, and that carried the heavy-weighted tech sector up 0.9% and the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index up 1.4% in its wake. In addition to the Apple news, rumors continued to circulate that congressional leadership was close to making a deal. I would say that the last of the big catalysts I want to focus on came on Wednesday with the last FOMC policy announcement and press conference of 2020. The Fed kept rates at zero, no surprise there, and while they increased the forecast for GDP growth projections for 2021, it did nothing to adjust their asset purchase program plans or interest rate projections at the zero bound out to 2023. Their projections for inflation remain tame at 1.8% for 2021, 1.9% in 2022, and 2% in 2023. Chairman Powell continued that message in the conference, saying that any increase in inflation due to vaccine efforts releasing pent-up demand in the economy would be transient. Whether investors agree in 2021, as shown in bond yields, will be another thing entirely for us to watch. Overall, the main message is that the Fed is maintaining its extraordinary policy accommodation with no immediate plans to ratchet down its $120 billion asset purchase program each month or move its zero bound for short-term rates, while at the same time, Chairman Powell was pounding the table for the case for more fiscal stimulus. The meeting caused gold and silver to rally and created a new intermediate uptrend for those metals this week, and Bitcoin caused it to break out to all-time record highs. On the economic news side of things this week, industrial production was up 0.4% in November, and the number I liked seeing is a rise in capacity utilization, which rose to 73.3%. Capacity utilization is the rate at which the fullness of the economy is able to be utilized and worked. So, example, if you have a factory in Indiana and that factory is not working, or even though it could, that capacity utilization is down as a result. Now, retail sales were down 1.1% in November versus October, and the decline was broad-based. Both the manufacturing and services IHS market PMIs decelerated in December. The housing starts announcement Thursday, however, was up 1.2% in November, which led to a nice rally in housing stocks, with the iShares U.S. Home Construction ETF up 4%. Building permits were up 6.2%, which shows the low interest rate environment continues to powerfully influence that part of the economy. Now, the last area I wanted to comment on, it wasn't a catalyst this week, but is the stimulus. While there has been very positive news on the vaccine approvals in December and November, the first half of December has largely been stocks consolidating, with news that's been mostly priced in addition to an overbought market and hints of speculation as seen in the IPO valuations we saw last week. But who would short the market with Congress on the verge of launching a new stimulus package, right? As it stands on Friday, both sides of the aisle are still divided on a couple of items such as state funding and Fed powers, but what may result is two bills, one thing they're considering. There were reports on Wednesday that Congress was near a deal of around $900 billion that would include direct paychecks, enhanced unemployment benefits, small business relief, and funding for the Paycheck Protection Program, the PPP. State and local aid and liability protection were still the areas of contention that would not be in this bill. As of midday Friday, as we go here to record, the contention still in the bill was felt, as a deal would not be as immediate as thought midweek. Finally, another nice soundbite fell on us Friday, with FedEx beating both top and bottom line estimates, with the added statement that the shipments were above pre-pandemic levels. And I tell you what, I'll take that good news to end the week. And that's it for the wrap-up report. And since we go on break for the last 2 weeks of the year for the show, I just want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in this year. The ups and downs and all of the internet memes have been aplenty for 2020, so it would be nice to put this one behind us. So we're definitely happy to continue making financial sense of the markets with all of you next year. Until then, I wish you all a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
FS Insider spoke with Rick Mills of the widely read Ahead of the Herd newsletter on the four major themes driving a new commodity bull market and the one commodity that he thinks, above all, is going to do the best in the years ahead. Here's a clip of what he had to tell listeners on FS Insider this week.
Commodities have performed very well. Copper, iron ore, add in zinc and nickel, and a whole host of other raw materials have seen a huge price increase. And there is a lot of talk about, are we entering another commodities bull market? A super cycle, as many, including myself, were calling it back in 2003. And at Head of the Herd, we believe we are. We think we're on the cusp of a real global all-encompassing commodities bull market that is going to make the 2003 super cycle pale in comparison.
If you want to listen to this full interview, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, despite all the difficulties we're starting to see in the economy and with the virus, the stock market keeps powering higher. There's talk of another stimulus in the tune of $1 trillion, and the Fed announces it's going to keep helping this economy, in other words, keeping interest rates low for a long time. Where will this market be heading? Let's find out with Ron Williams. He joins us from RW Advisory. Ron, everything, if you look at these charts, they look very bullish in terms of the NASDAQ, the Dow Jones Industrials, even the Transportation Index. No matter where you're looking, emerging markets, everything's going up. How long will this last?
Great question, and really feeds through to the framework that we use, which is primarily behavioral technical analysis, but driven by cycles. And it's the cycle element, which is quite key at moments like this. The trend is your friend until signs of reversal emerge. And so that's where we're at the moment, that tipping point, according to our cycle work. So we're calling it the Minsky moment, after the work of Hyman Minsky, American economist, that basically coined the phrase that stability leads to instability. And we've seen a whole lot of irrational exuberance in the summer months, which looks like we're at a make or break point. Now, looking at the global cross-asset ranking model that my mentor and colleague Robin Griffiths has used for many years, that basically shows top-ranking business cycle-sensitive markets such as oil and copper leading, which is the risk-on trade per se. But actually, out of the global equity market complex, it ain't in the West, it's in the East. The pendulum has swung, and we see India, Japan leading. And there's a big kind of crisis opportunity call I have there that we can discuss later. Western markets are strong but underperforming in the short term because, of course, they're unwinding from overbought conditions. China, interestingly, is relatively weak, consolidating after having that first-in, first-out advantage through the pandemic. And gold is actually at the bottom of our table, not because it's not the market to own, but just because it's been a relative underperformer in this setback that we've seen. So that's the short to medium term in terms of our model. But the big call is risk ahead going into the new year.
And when you take a look at this, when you're seeing all markets go up, a lot of people may not realize that the gains in the S&P this year were driven by a handful of stocks. Can we talk about that? I'm talking about the Googles, the Apples, the Microsofts, you know, Netflix, those kind of stocks. And then another one is Tesla. I mean, you have Tesla, which is, I forget how much this stock is up this year. It's up like 500-600%, and it's worth more than the world's entire auto industry.
It's been a speculative, irrational wave into the second half of this year, and it's been a welcome respite from what has been a pandemic shock in the early half. So in a way, we've got this game of two halves, this so-called V-shaped recovery, which we think will ultimately be false and turn into a rolling W retest off the crash lows. That's our primary call in terms of the risk-on, risk-off trade. But in terms of what you mentioned about the elevated stocks that have really rocketed the markets higher, that's what we call the fang-tastic, pun intended, trade, which has been profitable. And it's difficult to stand in the way of a winning, profitable trade, particularly when a lot of first-time traders at the margin, the so-called Robin Hood traders, their first trade was a winning trade from the March lows. And that included Tesla, that included Fang, but it also included bankrupt stocks. So we're in the everything bubble era right now. And it's great while it lasts, but at some point in time, we will hit the end of the party and we will need to wake up from this unsustainable bull run. And that is the whole premise behind Minsky moment. It's stability leading to instability. When we least expect it, the market falls under its own weight. But one of the reasons why is it's excessive speculation driven by credit, and credit that is likely to hit some kind of a tipping point in the near term.
So a lot of this liquidity, which has been finding its way in the market. Now, I want to talk about interest rates and the possibility that they could spike even higher. We saw them hit a low around August, but now we've had rates almost double on the 10-year, and the 30-year is rising. Where do you see interest rates heading, and could this be a problem for the market going forward?
Yeah, so two interesting points here. So firstly, in terms of the short-term sentiment indicators, I just recently looked at the readings from Bank of America, and they have yield curve expectations at record highs at the moment. I've just sent it there on the slide 19. So yield curve expectations back to trend highs last seen in 2016, 13, and 2008. So that's a likely kiss of death kind of sentiment indication. And in terms of how that fits in with our kind of medium to long-term view, we think that rates will rise over the next few years, but not in the way that consensus view has been positioning. So we don't think this is the inflationary new trend in rates. We think this is more of a deflationary spike. And the parallel goes back to the 1930s, 1931 and 1937, where we last saw an accelerated spike in yields, which was ultimately default driven, and that led to a prolonged bear market.
And speaking of that, let's talk about something that looks like it's in a bear market, and that's the U.S. dollar.
Yes, so we're in a make or break territory at the moment, the U.S. dollar. So multi-year, we've got a big top accumulation pattern. And so the old phrase is the bigger the top, the lower the drop. But we're undecided at the moment whether we've actually rolled over in that bearish phase. We think potentially we could be approaching oversold levels and have a surprise rally if and when volatility spikes going into either year end or new year with a greater risk for new year first quarter.
So with the dollar falling, let's talk about something that's doing well, like anything else. Let's talk specifically about commodities. And in particular, I want to talk about copper, which is on fire, and then also the recovery recently that we've seen in some of the oil prices. We had that narrow trading range around 40, 43 bucks, and now it looks like oil's breaking out a little bit. What's your take on commodities here?
Yes, so certainly strong trends on the commodity complex, and specifically the ones you mentioned, copper and oil, although we're looking at potentially short-term overbought conditions at the moment. So although they're actually top in our ranking model, oil, we think it's more just off the fact you had that kind of that negative V-shaped recovery from minus $40. So we're still recovering from that, and the demand supply situation has leveled off somewhat. But at the moment, I think copper at the moment is likely to have a short-term correction as part of this counter-cyclical trade if we start to see more of a risk-off environment. The commodity that we're getting a little bit more excited about from medium to long-term is actually the safe haven one, and that's gold. So a lot of people kind of lost some love for gold in that consolidation and drop into the 200-day moving average. But we've now just confirmed a monthly bounce from that line in the sand for the third time in the last 2 years as part of this six-year trend. And if we kind of flip the nuance about technical analysis patterns, the bigger the base, the higher in space, we're looking for gold to head up to 2,400 and maybe even spike into 3,000. On the back of a double positive whammy. So absolute performance in gold, but also relative safe haven attributes, especially during a volatile market. So we're looking for rainy day de-risking portfolio assets right here, right now. And gold seems to be a good value and a great buy the dip trade.
And speaking of things that are doing well, how about cryptocurrencies? Let's talk about Bitcoin, which is, as we're speaking, is close to 24,000.
Yes. So I mean, that was our next target hit. And of course, the way Bitcoin tends to trade, 20% average day volatility. So it can move pretty fast, particularly on the upside. But it can be a two-way market. And so we do see, you know, likely some kind of a step back in maybe the coming weeks, because it has played as some of the speculative greed trade in recent weeks. Having said that, we're a little bit concerned that some of the other cryptocurrencies, the alternative coins, but the actual well-known and respected ones are still diverging. So we're not sure whether that's a catch-up trade or whether that's a warning signal that the market might be overbought. But either way, we're bullish medium to long-term on Bitcoin and crypto, particularly within this halving cycle, 4 years, which tends to be definitely skewed on the upside. And I've just highlighted the chart there showing the halving cycles throughout history lead to big, big, big upside opportunities, particularly when safe haven plays come back into favor.
So if you had to look at the two, what impact do you think cryptocurrencies are having on gold? Gold has been sort of meandering here in the last couple of months.
Well, gold's the sure and steady trade, I think, for now. Bitcoin, if you're looking out more into the long term and you're okay to win some and lose some in terms of the 5,000 coins out there, unless you're just betting on Bitcoin, there is a little bit more risk in our mind. It is certainly a good hedge, but we're not perma bulls on Bitcoin. I think we also keep in mind that it is very volatile and it isn't a substitute for gold. So we're quite old school and traditional in terms of preferring that hard asset gold. But also the trend just seems to be a little bit more steady and consistent, and maybe that much better for portfolio de-risking.
So given what you think may happen in the new year, let's talk about something that could cause you to change that opinion. If there's anything that would cause you to, let's say, we're not heading for a Minsky moment, what would you like to see to avoid that?
Yeah, so the big turnaround signal, because of course, I mean, calling market tops are precarious at the best of times. So we've learned to be conservative, especially in these current markets where the rational exuberance is off the charts. So the big downside trigger on markets like the US and specifically S&P 500 is, I mean, 3,000 psychological figure, big round number. But also that is the 2018 prior record high. Now, if you look at that from a crowd psychology point of view, that entire area is a potential bull trap signal if the market were to roll down back down lower. Now, I know we're trading above 3,600. That's our immediate risk level because, of course, that's part of the multi-month top formation that we've been developing. If you back up on the chart going several years, there is what is called a megaphone or broadening pattern. Sounds illustrious, but all that means is there's an imbalance between buyers and sellers, big disagreement, and a self-feeding, expanding volatility situation. We see that resolving to the downside as part of a rolling retest of the crash lows. Now, what would put that on hold and flip the market risk from down to up? The market keeping on doing what it's been doing now and actually just holding above these levels. We're a little bit concerned that there is a loss of momentum in a way that's natural because the market's been moving excessively higher. But we do need further confirmation. Even markets like the Dow 30,000, big historic record level not seen before, especially during a pandemic year. But at the same time, we haven't seen an impulsive breakout from that level. In my mind, the better kind of early cycle trade is in Japan 30,000. Look at Japan 30,000, 32,000 as part of a recovery from a 30-year bear. We're now retracing two-thirds of what we saw in 1989. And many of the other Asian markets are outperforming India 20-year highs, maybe overbought, but still looking like a roaring bull market. And so it's more bearish in Western markets and maybe a little bit more bullish in the long term in Asian markets. A flip from, in our view, would be continuing to see these trends go up, but we would need to see some kind of correction just to keep this trend healthy.
So given where you see things heading in the new year, as an investor, what would you be doing? Would you be putting a hedge if you're in the markets? Would you be taking profits off the table? Would you be redirecting assets or dollars into other areas? What would you be doing here?
So certainly, I think it's a great opportunity going into year end to take profits. A number of investment managers will be doing that naturally. So while people talk about the Santa Claus rally, that might happen less so this year, given that we had such a strong V-shaped recovery already. So we might actually start to see that. Now, according to, again, going back to the sentiment figures from Bank of America, they also interestingly have cash, I think net percentage of investors underweight cash for the first time since 2013. We think that's a warning signal and maybe an opportunity for people to maybe start to build up a little bit of cash or at least de-risking into safe havens like gold, minimum weighting and fixed income, where that might have some tail risk going into the new year, particularly if rates go up or if we get a curve steepener situation. So I think safety is key, and being prepared ahead of time, not after the fact, is always going to be the name of the game in terms of these types of precarious moments.
Well, you know, those Minsky moments, I mean, we had sort of one of those at the beginning of the year in February, where in three short weeks, we lost about 38%. It just came out of the blue with the pandemic, and who knows what else is lurking out there. Well, listen, Ron, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow you, how could they do so, please?
Yes, so website is rwadvisory.com, otherwise for social media. The Twitter handle is RWA, or my first and last name, Ron William, RWA. Happy to follow up with any questions or maybe speak a little bit more on the cycle work that we do.
All right. Well, listen, Ron, thanks for coming on the program. Stay safe and happy holidays.
Lynn Alden joined FS Insider this week to discuss the fraying of the global monetary order as China and other countries circumvent the post-Bretton Woods petrodollar system. Lynn explains why investors should prepare for long-term dollar weakness and where Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, including commodities as well, may fit into the new system being created. Here's a clip of what she told listeners.
Starting in the early to mid-1970s, that new system really kind of coalesced around the petrodollar. And so the way that works is that the United States was experiencing rapid inflation and had trouble getting the commodities it needs. But eventually, the United States made a deal with Saudi Arabia, where Saudi Arabia would price all of their oil in dollars, regardless of who's buying it from them. And so that has been how the system has been structured for the past, 45 to 50 years. Now, in 2013, China declared that it was no longer in their interest to continue to accumulate treasuries. And so they were still running these very big dollar surpluses with the United States and still accumulating a lot of dollars. But then instead of recycling those back into U.S. treasuries, they started making dollar loans to developing countries around the world to develop their infrastructure and to secure commodity exposure for China.
If you want to listen to this full interview, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we keep a watchful eye on the markets, continually assessing the investment landscape so you can focus on the things that matter most. Don't put your hard-earned wealth at risk. Give us a call at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA and SIPC. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, a registered investment advisor.
Well, the price of energy is stabilized. It's been gradually drifting upward. There's a lot of talk about, what's OPEC going to do and where is the price of energy heading? Will it be heading higher or lower as the economy picks up, as we eventually get COVID under control? Let's find out. Joining me on the program is Marshall Atkins from Raymond James. Marshall?
So there's a lot of layers to the whole ESG and fossil fuel divestment and really the perception that energy developed by hydrocarbons is going away. Let's start with the financial aspect of ESG. There's a ton of money pouring into ESG funds and complete lack of capital, unlike I've ever seen, flowing into fossil fuels. And whenever this has happened in any industry over history, the industries where there's a lot of capital chasing it tend to get very low absolute rates of return over time. And vice versa, those industries that are starved for capital, such as oil and gas right now, tend to have very high returns. And so what I find intriguing about this push to get Exxon and everyone else to start doing green energy, and you've certainly seen BP, you're starting to see Shell and others go that route. They are exchanging projects that are generating well into the double-digit rate returns for projects that at best are low single-digit returns. And they explain away the difference. Well, we can make money trading energy and still be green. So it's really political pressure driving them to do it. And it's political pressure driving everyone towards this go green or ESG. Many people make the point that, electric cars are just like transitioning from the horse and buggy to gasoline-driven cars at the turn of the century. No. It's not like that at all. The gasoline engine was a better product. Likewise, some people compare it to, it's the cell phone evolution versus landline. No, it's not. Cell phones were a better option, and that's why they captured market share. The push towards windmills, solar, and electric vehicles is totally being driven by government policies, and it's being funded by taxpayers around the world. And so if you weren't offering electric vehicles for below cost via subsidies of various governments, they would not be gaining any share. So what I've, now, the whole purpose there is to gain critical mass and to get past the high cost curve so that they become cheaper, and maybe they will become cheaper over time. Although I would argue the carbon footprint of those things, of all aspects of green energy, is much, much bigger than the green advocates want you to believe. A lot of this is being pushed by Europe. Keep in mind they are massive net importers of hydrocarbons. And if you make hydrocarbons more expensive and outlaw hydrocarbons, then they win, because our cost of energy is way, way lower than the cost of energy in Europe, because we have access to abundant, cheap hydrocarbons. Specifically here in Houston, I'm paying about 7 or 8 cents per kilowatt hour for electricity. The average German pays 35 cents per kilowatt hour for electricity. And the ratio is similar for industry. So if you have an energy intensive industry, think steel or something like that, that low cost of energy that we enjoy is a huge competitive advantage. If they want to eliminate that competitive advantage that we have, great. Make everyone go green and you take away the hydrocarbon cost advantage that we have over the rest of the world. In terms of electric vehicles, I was reading a piece today that, it's the beginning of the end for internal combustion engines, that electric vehicles are going to replace them by, 2025 or whatever. The number of electric vehicles that exist in the world is de minimis. It's not even 1% of the total cars in the world. It's 0.3% currently. Sure, it's going to grow at a exponential rate because governments are mandating it and there's massive cost incentives being funded by taxpayers. But you have a long way to go before you displace gasoline-powered cars or diesel-powered trucks or the current system we have for moving people and goods and services around the planet. So I think the demise of energy is very exaggerated. Maybe it happens a decade, 2 decades from now, maybe, but that depends on the willingness of the people to continue funding the evolution of these other technologies, which may or may not continue over time. China's already backed away from their funding of electric vehicles because it came too expensive. Likewise, the returns that you will see investors enjoy in hydrocarbons, I think, will be way outsized versus other parts of the economy because we're capital starved. Just like you capital starved the tobacco business at the turn of the century. And for the 15 years after the tobacco settlement from 2000 to 2015, tobacco is one of the best performing sectors in the entire market. It outperformed the broader market by 20-fold. And that's the consequence of starving a sector of capital. Likewise, I think solar and wind are doomed to subpar returns, but people will certainly feel good about making those subpar returns.
I read something, Marshall, that I think this would demonstrate for our listeners the folly of going all green, and it's something like for a single electric car battery weighing 1,000 pounds requires extracting and processing some 500,000 pounds of materials. Averaged over battery life, each mile of driving an electric car consumes 5 pounds of earth. Using an internal combustion engine consumes about 0.2 pounds of liquid per mile. So oil, natural gas, and coal are needed to produce the concrete, steel, plastics, purified minerals used to build green machines. The energy equivalent, and here's the thing that gets me, the energy equivalent of 100 barrels of oil is used in the process to fabricate a single battery that can store the equivalent of 1 barrel of oil. I mean, that says it all.
Yeah, there's a reason. Electric cars were actually some of the first automobiles made. And there's a reason we ended up with internal combustion engines is the method by which the automobile business was built. And that's because they are way more efficient at converting power to transportation. It's true with not just cars, but obviously airplanes and everything else. It's the perfect store of energy, and it already exists, and it's cost effective. Yes, there are emissions associated with it, and there's certainly some component of global warming that's being driven by CO2 emissions. Can we do it cleaner? Sure. And I think evidence of that is the fact that really, if you go back to the Kyoto or Paris Accords, the U.S. has seen some of the greatest reductions of CO2 emissions of any country out there, not because of law changes or mandates or anything, but because natural gas has become cost competitive with coal, and we've eliminated coal in favor of natural gas, which has substantially lower CO2 emissions. And all of these emissions arguments do ignore the fact that there's still a massive component of the world, a third of the world living in poverty, and they're still burning cow dung or wood or things like that that are have massive health implications from particulate matter pollution. And they're doing that because they can't afford propane or natural gas or the things the developed world has to just cook their food, much less power chargers for cell phones or light bulbs or anything else. So if you force this conversion to all electric, which is very expensive compared to hydrocarbons, then you doom, you know, a third of the world to live in poverty longer than they would in a hydrocarbon-powered world.
So when does this start to kick in, Marshall, with prices? I mean, if we take a look at the energy sector, I mean, it's popped recently, but it's been one of the worst performers. As you said, it's been starved for capital the last couple of years with ESG. When does this start to catch up? Because we saw a dramatic drop-off in demand with COVID as a result of air travel, people being quarantined. When does this flip around? We got the first vaccine administered yesterday. So as more and more vaccines come out and we get COVID under control, what about demand in the economy, not only just here, but the rest of the world?
Right. Well, there's several things that will drive that recovery, and I'll walk through those things before I give you the bottom line. But there's no question energy has been a horrible performer really over the past decade. It's underperformed as our application of horizontal drilling technology has made the U.S. one of the lowest cost areas in the world. And if you lower the cost of a commodity, guess what? The companies that participate in that market tend to suffer. It's been obviously very extreme with the emergence of COVID in terms of the impact on the energy business, with demand for hydrocarbons and everything else getting hit extremely hard. And this is a commodity where 1 or 2% swing in demand or supply has massive implications on pricing. Prices collapsed earlier this year, and that has driven activity to record lows. We've gone from 800 rigs drilling for oil and gas in the U.S. to a low of about 250 rigs drilling for oil and gas a few months ago. We've never seen that percentage decline in such a short period of time. We've never seen that absolute level of a low point in drilling activity in the U.S. And that's, you know, real people's jobs and livelihoods and everything else. And there's consequences to that, not just, you know, consequences upon the people in the industry, but if you shut down drilling, it is a declining asset. And production will fall as it is. And so the consequences of these low energy prices and starvation of capital are that you're going to see meaningfully lower U.S. production. You're already seeing it. We're down about 2 million barrels a day off of a base of 13 million a day in crude production. That is likely to continue at current prices. And you marry that with the fact that production is falling outside the U.S. for the same reasons. We're not putting as much money in the ground. And you marry that ultimately with a recovery in demand, which the broader market is telling you that, hey, once this vaccine gets dispersed over the next 6 months, the there's pent-up demand for the economy. We're going to see the economy come roaring back, and that's why the stock market's pushing all-time highs. And so the consequence of substantially lower activity and lower production with recovering demand over the course of 2021 will leave us severely short of crude. In fact, we've been undersupplied for the last 6 months, but that undersupply has been facilitated by OPEC to try to renormalize inventories. The problem is the underpinnings of the rest of supply and demand are such that even if OPEC ramps to max capacity as we go through 2021, we're still going to end up with, number one, way lower than normal inventories coming into the early 22, but an inability to improve that situation because it takes time to ramp back up drilling activity and ramp back up increased oil production in the face of what we expect to be rising demand next year. So I think we're going to be severely short crude. I think you're in the early stages of this oil price increase as we push up towards $50. And I think we're on our way towards $80 or higher towards the back half of 2021. Now, I would caution you that forecast is way out of bounds in terms of consensus. You know, most people are thinking we stay at 45 to 50 for a long period of time. And that just ignores the fundamental nature of commodities such as oil and gas. When you are undersupplied or oversupplied by very small amounts, you tend to get extreme moves in price. We were oversupplied the first half of this year and the price of oil went to 10. Most of these same pundits were not expecting the price of oil to go to 10. Likewise, they're all saying, oh, you stay about where you are at 45 to 50 for the next, you know, 5 years. No, when you're undersupplied and you can't change that undersupply at 45, the market will send a price signal and it's not 55 or 60 or 65. It's a price meaningfully higher than that. So I think the die is cast for oil prices to move up meaningfully over the course of 2021.
So, Marshall, given your assessment of where you think energy is going and the industry being starved for capital, if you were to play this, would an investor be safer in getting an ETF like XLE, or would you be better looking and shopping either in the majors, mid-tiers, or some of the smaller companies?
Yeah, I can't discuss specific names, but I can speak generically that I think E&Ps are poised to do extremely well early. And that's because if you've structured your business to be break-even, say, at $40, and the price oil goes to 45 or 50, pretty much all of that flows to the bottom line. So there's this exponential growth in free cash flow as the price moves higher. Particularly as you go to 55 or 60 or 65, again, those cash flows will get absurdly high. I think there's been a change in mindset of U.S. E&P companies to, given the capital starvation they've experienced. Investors are demanding a return of capital. They want dividends. They want to see a yield. So I think you're going to see a substantial yield, either in the form of dividends or stock buybacks, but they're going to have to give money back to shareholders. In addition, I think you will see enough excess capital being generated to where they can pay down debt. And most of them have already paid down a lot of the debt. But in addition to paying down debt, I think you're going to see them starting to grow again, because that's what we need to see. We're going to be short of crude if they don't start putting more money back into the ground. So it'll be a combination of three things. Number one, giving capital back to the equity holders. Number two, paying down debt to take some of the risk off the business. And number three, eventually putting money back into the ground. And so that's why at 60, 65, 70, or 80, where I think things go, E&Ps will see an exponential improvement in their earnings and cash flow profile. Likewise, well, services is poised to see the biggest percentage gains, but it's going to take time. Keep in mind they're a second derivative play off of the E&Ps doing better. Those E&Ps have to start spending money on drilling, putting money back into the ground before the service guys win. So services is more a 2022 effect on their earnings. That said, the market is already anticipating that improvement. Many oil service stocks, which are down 90%, have already doubled off the bottom, which feels really great when they've doubled off the bottom, but they're still down 80% from where we were 18 months ago. So I do think oil services will work, but you got to maybe be a little bit more patient in that regard. You could just play crude only, but the ETF that exists for crude is fairly inefficient. So I wouldn't recommend doing that.
Well, listen, stay safe, my friend, and have a happy holiday.
Merry Christmas to you as well.
Joining us on the show today is Chris Poplava, the CIO of Financial Sense Wealth Management. Chris, let's talk about the weekly investment meeting that we posted this week on financialsense.com. You started off talking about and showing some charts related to the excessive bullish sentiment that we see and what this means. Give us an idea just how bullish are investors right now, and what does this mean for the markets in the near term?
Well, one of the things we've been seeing this year, especially since March when everyone started working from home, is record number of accounts being opened at brokerages like Schwab, Fidelity, and so forth. And with a lot of these brand new brokerage accounts, we're seeing a little bit of excessive bullishness. We saw that back in 2015 in China, where China had record accounts being opened, and that led to a mini bubble there in China. We're seeing a little bit of that here in the US, where we're seeing record call option volume right now in the US. So it does spell a little bit of excessive bullishness. It's not just if you look at the call option relative to put option. So overall option volume is incredibly high, but it's mostly in call options, those who are expecting the market to head higher. And if you look at the number of puts versus calls, we're hitting record low levels. So it does, to me, present a little bit of a headwind for the market, the elevated sentiment. Usually the market likes to climb a wall of worry, but I would say there's no wall right now. Instead, there's a little bit of excessive bullishness. So it kind of reminds me of what happened late 17 going into early 2018. The market rallied strongly in December of 17 and carried through to January of 2018, which was one of the best Januaries on record, and then ultimately led to a pretty sharp decline in February. So I do think we need to cool off a little bit here as things are getting a little bit excessive.
Okay, so near-term risk is we see excessive bullish sentiment that could unwind very quickly. As many of us know, it requires a catalyst. What are some of the things that you're looking at that could present that catalyst for a correction, either, you know, later this year or maybe the start of 2021?
I think the biggest risk right now are to U.S. households. There's a lot of programs, federal and state, that are getting set to expire. The Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, that's due to expire on December 26th. There's 9.15 million people on that program. And the Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation, that's set also to expire on that December 26th. And we've got 4.5 million people on that. Currently, there's over 6 million people in regular state programs and just under a million people on other programs. And a lot of these programs, you're going to have a lot of people that are going to be falling off of these. And so the concern would be if they do lose this assistance financially, that we could see a sharp contraction in consumer spending. This is also a concern when you come, when you look at housing. There was an article done recently by Bloomberg highlighting the U.S. Census Bureau's Household Pulse Survey. And the one of the charts that was pretty troubling was called Dark Winter. And it's looking at the percentage of adults living in households that are not current on rent or mortgages and possibly face eviction or foreclosure notices in the next 2 months. And the highest percentage goes up to the low 40s. And we see that across most of the country. Those that are 30 to a little over 40% likely to enter foreclosure or eviction. We've got California, Nevada, Oregon, Idaho, Utah, Arizona, Wyoming, South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas. I mean, I would say almost 60, 70% of the country, there's at least a 1/3 chance of residents there facing foreclosure. So that is a huge, huge concern that we have a huge hit to homeowners and renters who are behind on their payments, that we could have some serious trouble. And it really underscores the reason why we need further fiscal stimulus. We have so many people who are unable to work because of closures and lockdowns, and they can't survive. I mean, a couple of studies, we've looked at years ago was how many months of emergency savings the average American has. And it was 1 month, was the average, I believe. And so, how do we go months and months and months without assistance or without the ability to earn a living? It makes sense that we have so much in the country in trouble. And again, it really underscores that if governments are going to lock down in businesses, that they need to provide the assistance so that people don't lose their homes and businesses.
So you have a chart where you show that a number of these federal programs are set to expire the day after Christmas, so December 26th. So is the idea that perhaps sometime around there, later this year, starting the beginning of 2021, when these things may start to impact the economy and the markets?
That would be the case unless there could be further extensions. I remember back in 2008, 2009, with a really high unemployment rate with the Great Financial Crisis, that a lot of the programs are set to expire, but then they were continually extending the length of unemployment assistance until the economy got going again. And I think they needed to do that in this situation. I think we need to refund the programs to help people and extend the benefits until the economy gets up and running again, until the lockdowns are ceased to exist. And until that happens, we definitely need some federal support. The federal government's going to prevent the economy from operating at full capacity. Then they need to provide the assistance until we can get through this.
So it sounds like, given how we start off this conversation, pointing out that we see excessive bullish sentiment, in some cases at record levels that we haven't seen in quite some time, if not ever, that the risks are a little bit higher at this point. And so if we don't see some type of headway made with stimulus, or like you said, an extension of some of these forbearance programs that are set to expire December 26th, that we could be looking at a meaningful correction in the near term, if not, perhaps as early as later this year or the beginning of 2021. Given this situation, what would you say to investors, or what are you doing at Financial Sense Wealth Management for clients?
We have continued monetary stimulus. Powell basically gave the green light on that this week, stating that he's not going to raise rates anytime soon. Worse the data gets, the more likely we are to get a fiscal stimulus package and even maybe a larger package as the data continues to worsen. So I think that just means that, things might be a little bit rocky in the coming weeks and months here with elevated sentiment and some possible, hit and setback to the economy. But as we reopen, as the vaccines get underway, There's still plenty of stimulus that I do think will have a bullish year next year. But, you know, a lot of people fixate on the stock market and equities, which if you look at this year, we've got record levels in the Dow, the S&P. Going into next year, though, I think the real key market to watch won't be the stock market, but in fact will be the fixed income market.
Yeah, one of the things that you had mentioned in the weekly investment meeting video was that a number of firms are advocating a minimum weight to bonds. And as you've been telling us on the Smart Macro segment here for past months and quite some time, is that we have been reducing our fixed income portion for clients. Is that essentially what you're going to be carrying forward into 2021? And what is the thinking behind that?
Part of the thinking behind that is if you look at QE, whenever we've had QE, that tends to lift, QE stands for quantitative easing in terms of the Fed expanding its balance sheet with purchases. When that's occurred in the past, that tends to lead to a rise in inflation expectations, which then also leads to a rise in interest rates. And so I think we're going to see a eventual breakout in interest rates, especially on the long end. Currently, the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield is under 1%. It's at 0.94. 30-year Treasury is roughly about 1.7%. I think we could see some steepening in the yield curve, which is pretty normal coming out of a recession where short-term rates are anchored and long-term rates start to move up on economic and inflation expectations. Another factor I see lifting the interest rates on the long end higher was some estimates from JP Morgan. They were looking at next year, and they're forecasting that the weighted average maturity of Treasury debt will rise above 70 months. And they're making that call because they believe that the issuance of T-bills will decline under 20% of net Treasury issuance in 21, meaning that 80% of Treasuries being issued next year, they believe, will be greater than one-year maturity. And so if you think of just supply and demand, the greater supply, the lower the price. And what that means is if you're going to be issuing a greater supply of long-term Treasuries, bond prices on the long end will fall and rates will rise because rates and bond prices move inversely. So I do think we could get some steepening on the yield curve next year as an excess supply of long-term Treasuries picks up and drives rates higher. We already kind of seen that if you look at the futures curve, if you look at inflation expectations. So I do think that we could see a dramatic rise in interest rates next year. Now, what the market does not want to see is a sharp rise in interest rates, similar to what we had in 2013. And what was interesting this week, Powell did make a comment that there will not be a taper-like tantrum in next year like there was in 2013, that everything the Fed does will be gradual. So, you know, that's encouraging. But I do think rates will move next year. And so you definitely want to be underweight fixed income, in my opinion, and be overweight equities over bonds. But over that, I think you kind of want to look at also where the opportunities might be in fixed income. Given our bullish outlook on the stock market relative to bonds, one of the things that we're looking at doing for clients, we have been over the last several months, are looking at convertible bonds. So these are bonds that act like a bond, pay a coupon, but they also have an embedded call option on them on the underlying security. So if the stock does well, we can convert that bond into the equity and have equity-like returns. So we think those look attractive over the coming years, as we think the stimulus will be here for a while. We're still early in the economic cycle. So I think the key area for those who manage balanced portfolios of stocks and bonds will be really shortening your duration, looking at possibly inflation-protected securities. And there's some other host of ideas that we've got for clients that we'll be shifting to protect them from a rise in interest rates next year.
So again, we see some excessive bullishness in the near term that heightens the risk for a correction and volatility, especially if we don't see some type of stimulus deal passed in coming weeks or months. However, 2021, you are a bit more positive. And as you said, you've been reducing your weighting towards fixed income, going underweight on bonds. And as you've been saying on our show now for some time, That's been paired with increasing allocation towards the commodity sector, and we've been having a number of different people on the show in recent weeks and months also aligning with that view, advocating that we could be in the beginning stages of a multi-year, if not another multi-decade, bull market in commodities. What is your outlook for commodities? Are you still bullish, and are you increasing your allocation in client portfolios to the commodity sector?
I am very bullish on commodities. One of the things that does a pretty good job of predicting trends in commodities is the amount of financial stimulus coming from China. And looking at some financial stimulus indicators from China, M1 and some other indicators, it does look like, which have a pretty good lead on commodity prices, that we should see a pretty dramatic rise in commodities next year. What also makes me bullish on commodities is that coming out of an economic downturn, usually commodity inventories are high as demand collapses. But with COVID and lockdowns, that also locked down the production of commodities and supply. So with low levels of inventories, I do think that this commodity cycle could be quite substantial. And so we have been allocating towards commodities, materials. And it also, to me, suggests that the U.S. dollar could weaken in the next year as global growth surprises to the upside. So I think commodities could have a bullish year. I think foreign currencies could have a pretty strong year next year. And we're taking advantage of that in client accounts and positioning them for these trends in 2021.
Well, it's interesting. We just spoke with Rick Mills from Ahead of the Herd newsletter, and he's been pretty bullish on copper for some time and for commodities as well. And he said this week on FS Insider that he believes copper is going to be a stellar performer for years to come because he's looking at both the demand and supply side of things. On the supply side, he said that we're looking at a major supply deficit with just not enough copper mines able to produce or keep up with the amount of demand as we switch to electric vehicles, to more green energy. So he had some really interesting thoughts on that in terms of the big picture drivers, not just for the commodity sector as a whole, but also for copper. And I know that this is an area that we have been moving into with clients as well. So I want to give you kudos for a lot of the things that you have been telling our listeners on the Smart Macro segment. So Chris, on that note, would you mind telling our listeners a little bit more about some of the services that we offer here at Financial Sense Wealth Management?
Sure. We provide financial planning, wealth management. We also do 401k servicing, consulting, and we also assist corporations in managing their cash balance, particularly with interest rates at 0%.
If any of our listeners would like to get in touch with our financial advisors, what would be the best way to do so?
They can give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Chris, it was a pleasure speaking with you again on Smart Macro. We look forward to speaking with you in another 2 weeks.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.